how do you incorporate the mindfulness work into couples that have sexual issues?
Ah, that is a place where mindfulness is exceedingly useful. And one of my mentors in the sex therapy field, Suzanne Iacenzes, really put together a beautiful way that she gives people, and I do this as well, to give people an exercise, right? Maybe it's just massaging each other's hands. Maybe it is touching each other's bodies, but being able to get in touch again with the thoughts, the feelings, and what it's like in the body.
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy. Hello, listeners. Just a little mention again, as we mentioned, I believe, last time, we've switched back over to just audio. That makes it accessible to you folks on Spotify. If you, those of you on Spotify, if you notice that, hey, how come the last time you were on here was like a year and a half ago, and now you're back? It's because we had all those videos in between, and if you're a coming to us from one of those platforms that doesn't do videos, if you want to see a lot of really cool episodes in between, please go to our website, ctn7.com. That's the number 7, ctn7.com, and you'll be able to see all of our episodes, including the video ones. But here we are on audio.
Here we are.
And Judy, tell folks, what's the title of our episode today?
Our title is Mindfulness, Sex, and Vulnerability. An interview with Wendy Dumbroff.
And we've just completed that interview, and it was just delightful. She's really interesting and very knowledgeable.
Is. She's a couples therapist, sex therapist.
Also works with individuals.
Yes, works with individuals. Indeed. Yes.
Yeah, and the way she uses mindfulness in the course of her work, including with couples, although she pointed out, it's not like she'll sit there and do meditations very often with couples,
right.
But it sort of imbues all of her work. And I just thought it was fascinating. And I mentioned, here's a teaser for you folks, I mentioned at one point, after she talks about her journey into the work, and I'm sitting there and I say in the podcast, oh my God, I think that we are spiritual siblings. And
yes,
if you want to know why I say that, listen to the podcast.
Very similar paths.
Listen to
you?
The interview and you'll hear why it's like, whoa, sort of uncanny in some
right?
ways. Yeah.
So before we get to our interview with Wendy, we have some stuff to talk about us.
We do indeed. So,
like you mentioned, yes. We're now back to just audio on our podcast. So I think that there are some places that carry just audio. They don't do video. So we're welcoming back our audio visitors who've said, we want to listen to you.
Yes, indeed. And we've been interviewed on some podcasts as well. Mm-hmm. And I blog about that, by the way, folks. If you want to check out my blog, it's brucechalmer.com /blog if you want. Or if you go to my couples therapy website, you go to brucechalmer.com, there's a thing to click to get to my couples therapy website, and you'll see that's where the blog is hanging out. Mm-hmm. I should put a link to that right on my homepage.
And then we have our couples, our podcast, ctn7.com website, where you can find all of our podcast episode, and you can also find links to buy Bruce's latest book, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
And I have to crow about the fact that for a brief shining moment, well, it was actually a couple of days, as a matter
yes,
of fact,
it
was the number one bestseller in one of its categories, Couples and Family Therapy, which is a perfectly appropriate category for it. And it was the number one bestseller on Amazon. And I am just really psyched about that, as the kids don't say anymore. As the kids said when I was a kid.
Right? What do they say now?
I have no idea what they say now.
I think juiced is no longer there.
I don't know.
We're just too old.
If you're a kid listening to this, which is based on our demographics, probably not. But if you are, or if you know what the kids say, tell us what the kids say. We want to know what the kids say. What do the kids say these days?
What do the kids say?
Yes. But in any case, yeah, the book hit number one, and of course we want to keep that momentum going. It's available on Kindle, such a deal. It's $2.99 on Kindle. That'll probably go up when, as the sales increase, actually.
Yeah.
But for now, I've got it at $2.99. It's available as an audiobook, where I did the narration. It's also available, of course, as a paperback from any place. If you don't like to buy from Amazon, and this is where you can cue the Darth Vader theme, you know, dum, bum, 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 yep. bum, whatever.
That's the one.
You can get it from my website. Actually, there's a direct link. You can get it from BookBaby, which is the folks who actually do the printing. You can get it from anywhere you like. Just ask them to order it and they'll order it for you.
Right. And one of the other new things that they will find out about is signing up for your newsletter.
Yes, indeed. You can sign up for my newsletter right from ctn7.com. A box will magically appear. It's just so exciting to see that box magically appear. That you should visit just to see that. Yes, I know, as I keep saying, I'm
just
overly impressed.
Just amazing how you are impressed with technology, especially since you're an early programmer and probably saw stuff that nobody had seen back in the day.
I go back to the punch card days, folks. That's my first programming I did was in Fortran using punch cards. That's how old I am, folks.
So it's amazing that you're impressed by this appearing box.
I am, which is like a simple thing when you're editing the website. But anyway, yeah, it's there. You click on that appearing box, and that will just give you a little sign-up form. All I ask for is your email and first name or a name, just something to call you. And you don't have to put any more in there. You can put your last name if you want to. And I don't spam you. I send you a newsletter it's about twice a month, I think. It's been every other week so far. And, the occasional extra something if there's some big exciting news to announce. But I don't spam you. I certainly don't share. I'm super careful about that. I do not share your email with anybody else for any reason. So you're not going to be, I have no idea what the heck, Google and all of those various, big brothers out there can figure out from what you do. But it's not because I'm doing it. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So I do, urge you to sign up.
Sign up for the newsletter.
Yeah, it's fun. I have tips. I have relationship tips. I have big ideas. I have news and schmooze. So please do that.
Yes.
So.
And when you're there, we also have
merch. We got merch on the CTN7 website. We got mugs. We got t-shirts. We got tote bags.
With our beautiful logo, our beautiful motto, Be Kind, Don't Panic, and Have Faith.
Yep.
And they make wonderful gifts along with our books.
They do, and I think I even have a link on there where you can buy the books. So, you can go right there to ctn7.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, without further ado,
let's get on with the interview.
So you'll hear Judy introducing our guest, and then we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Wendy Dumbroff. Wendy is a licensed professional counselor in private practice in Madison, New Jersey, where she specializes in individual, family, couples, and sex therapy. She is a certified teacher of mindfulness and meditation and brings these tools into her practice. As she explains, mindfulness helps people create a pause. It allows one to step back and say, "What are my thoughts and what are my feelings?" It creates a space for people to make different choices among many other benefits. Wendy, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for having me today.
We're delighted to have you. So we always like to start off with this question. Tell us, how did you get into the work that you do? Tell us about your own journey into this work.
Oh, okay. It's interesting because counseling is a second career for me. My first career, I was a pharmacist in my last life undergrad world, but counseling was something that I think I even thought about early on in my 20s after I had finished college and, being busy and one day you'll get to that. And then I got married and had a family and finally took the exploration into my own therapy. And was reminded how interested I was in that and life experiences along the way. And finally, I decided to take the plunge and go back to school. So in my early 40s, I did that. One of my supervisor mentors in my internships had trained at the Ackerman Institute for the Family. And she is, her name's Meg Smith, and she's just a wonderful, wonderful therapist. And I thought, wow, if I could be half as good as Meg, That would be great. And so I decided to do post-grad training at the Ackerman Institute and really loved the couples work and recognized that with couples comes sex. And that's a huge issue. So I wanted to learn more about that. So I continued to do post-grad training in sex therapy. The mindfulness sort of came with a little dabbling in co-leading some DBT, dialectical behavior therapy groups. And I had learned meditation back in the 90s, transcendental meditation. So I was already interested in mindfulness and meditation. And so that sort of reopened the door there, and I pursued my studies there as well. And I really do take all of what I have learned, my education from the Ackerman Institute, and of course experience and continued consultation groups with one of the senior faculty there, who I'll probably talk about today. And I use it all, the sex therapy, the couples therapy, and the mindfulness. They all blend so well together. Mm-hmm.
Wow, Wendy, as listening to that, I'm sitting here thinking, I think we are spiritual siblings. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I also, I don't know if you know about the two of us. I'm a couples therapist. Judy is you can speak for yourself.
An educator.
And, but it's also a second career for me. It's also, I got into it, through some of my own explorations. And I also trained at the Ackerman Institute. that was a brief training. It was an externship. It was basically, I think, a 3 or 4 week externship back in the early 90s. But also in my 40s, that's when I got into it. It's funny how we have parallels.
Okay. Something that is interesting. Wow. So it's always nice to meet a fellow Ackerman alum.
Yes, indeed. I really enjoyed that time. As I say, I think you had more extensive training there than I did, but I really benefited a lot from that externship that I did there. I also, mm-hmm. I ended up doing also a externship at the Brattleboro Institute, which I think some of the folks there had connections to Ackerman as well, as I recall.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Very so why don't you tell us a little bit, you talked a little bit about using all of the talents and skills that you had. How do you incorporate mindfulness practice in your couple sessions?
Yeah, very, very great question. And, for me, mindfulness has become such a overarching thread in my own personal life, and it really, everything, all the work that I do, whether it's couples or individual, because when mindfulness is just defining it, it's about awareness in the present moment, what is happening right now, without judgment, with, as Jack Kornfield, one of my teachers in the world of mindfulness, says, he calls it loving awareness, because it's whatever is being known, you also bring a loving presence to that. So if anger is being known, rather than being harsh with oneself and angry with oneself for feeling anger, to bring a loving, compassionate presence to, anger's here and it's hard to feel this. This doesn't feel good. Mm-hmm. And in couples work, one of the, when I work with couples, I look at what happens between people. I look at the interaction, what happens between them, rather than a linear focus of, if only you didn't do this, I wouldn't do this, right? Mm-hmm. You make me do this. And so I look, well, when they do that, what do you do? What do you feel? And then what do you do? And then when you do that, what does the other person do? So I look at it very interactionally. Mm-hmm. And when people are in those patterns, it's very automatic. So needing to slow that down, mindfulness is a great way to do that, because if you can take a pause and breathe and notice that you're getting, this is where I usually go into those patterns. I usually start yelling and screaming, or I usually shut down. And I notice that I'm about to do that. But since when you have awareness of what is happening, you have the wisdom of choice.
Yeah.
You can choose from a very wise place. I know I'm about to do this. I know this may not be useful. It never has been useful before. Mm-hmm. So I have a choice here.
It's interesting your description of, you know, focusing on the interaction. I often will note that the couple itself is a living organism, just as the individuals are.
Oh, yes.
And that's, you know, you're focusing on, gee, what is this? What's this organism doing? How is it? Sometimes I probably overuse the word panic. I sometimes mention that. I'll say, you know, I use that in a very broad sense. Mm-hmm. When the organism itself gets into a panic, that's indeed when it does all sorts of things. And there's a rationale for it in the moment, but of course it turns out to be, you know, often destructive for other things.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love thinking of that as a, if I can borrow that metaphor from going forward, but the couple as an organism that goes into panic.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Feel free. And of course, I'm sure I didn't make it up. I don't know where it came from. But
well, I'll quote you anyway.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes I'll note with folks during the pandemic, I've noted, you know, you sort of have to give, at least I feel, I have to give grudging credit to the COVID virus for being so damn clever. Mm-hmm. Because, and it's, and the patterns that will take over in a couple are often very similar. They're sort of like the COVID virus. It's like it figured, the pattern figures out just what buttons to press in each person to further freak out the other one.
Yes. And so
it perpetuates itself. It's like the COVID virus figured out, oh, what a clever idea. If I can be contagious before I'm symptomatic, they won't be able to stop me. It's brilliant. You got to give the damn thing credit, you know. Even right, genius.
Yes, there's a poem in there, I think.
Undoubtedly, yes.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear exactly what you mean. Yes. And when couples can take that breath, when the organism can take that breath, and as well as looking at the other, look within, turn in and look and say, what's happening here? Mm-hmm. Tara Brach, one of my other teachers in the world of mindfulness, she talks about taking the U-turn in. In that pause, there's a wonderful book by her called Radical Compassion, which goes through this RAIN meditation, RAIN. And it is really a process of what do I do in this U-turn? How can I get in touch with what's going on with me right now inside? And the R is to recognize, what am I experiencing? The A is to allow it. The I is to investigate it with kindness. And the N is, what does this feeling need to nurture it? And the I is a lot of the work that we do in therapy. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, do you, in fact, like when you're sitting with couples, do you take them through like a guided meditation sometimes, or how do you do that?
I have done that. Yes, I absolutely have done that. However, I find that in the limited time that we have for the couples therapy itself, there's not always enough time for that. Mm-hmm. I have done it. Sometimes, especially if conflict emerges and people are very amped up in the session, it's very triggered. It's obviously hard for anyone to take anything in that space. So being able to take a breath together and just step away from it for a moment and get in touch with what's happening in our bodies, it can be useful.
Yeah, that's John Gottman's thing about, I think he and Julie will have, they'll put pulse oximeters on people's fingers, and if it exceeds a certain rate, they go in separate rooms, you know.
Really? Wow. I know the Gottmans do that. But I've never put a pulse oximeter on.
No, me neither.
It's not real practical.
Nor is it practical to take a 20-minute break in the middle of a session, which is what they do also. It depends on the parameters you're working with.
Yeah. So, but what I will do, they may not recognize that I'm using mindfulness. It may not be in a formal meditation, but I will encourage questions that help them to turn in. You know, what's happening right now? I saw your face get an angry look and you turned away from your partner. Can we just be with this moment and turn in? Mm-hmm. Or if someone has tears, tears come up, right? Really just pause the session and honor what's happening, because obviously something is in there that is begging for unpacking. Mm-hmm. And in that way, just helping. And when I guess when I say that mindfulness flows throughout, that is the lens that I'm coming from. Like, let's understand exactly what's going on for this person right now. Mm-hmm. What are they feeling in their body? What is happening for them? Because, and sometimes they don't even know.
Sure. Yeah. How do you incorporate the mindfulness work into couples that have sexual issues?
That is a place where mindfulness is exceedingly useful. And one of my mentors in the sex therapy field, Suzanne Iacenzes, really put together a beautiful way that she gives people, and I do this as well, to give people an exercise, right? Maybe it's just massaging each other's hands. Maybe it is touching each other's bodies, but being able to get in touch again with the thoughts, the feelings, and what it's like in the body. And a la Suzanne, have them write that down in the moment and bring it to the session. Because when we can see everything else that we're adding on to what may be there, if you recognize, oh my goodness, I'm thinking about what am I going to make for dinner tomorrow, or the kids need to get picked up, or oh, I'm so uncomfortable with my body, I wish I wasn't being touched in this spot, or oh my God, is my penis going to work this time around? Mm-hmm. When we see all those things that get added on, right, we begin to recognize, well, how can you be having a enjoyable sexual experience when there's all this stress that's it there as well?
Yeah.
And just like with meditation, just sitting in formal meditation, perhaps using breathing as an anchor, when you notice all those thoughts and feelings, you can come back to the body. Mm-hmm. Just keep coming back to the body.
It's so interesting. I'd imagine, yeah, just the act of stepping back, you know, having the intention that you're not just going to experience, you're going to step back and notice the experience, which is what mindfulness is all about, you know, from one step removed from the panic, you know, mm-hmm. You say, yeah, oh, look at all those interesting feelings happening. You know, yes. I seem to be panicking, thinking, you know, X, Y, or Z. And just that act of doing it has the effect of sort of calming it, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably turns on, as Dan Siegel would say, turns on that, brings the prefrontal cortex back online when we begin to step back and name what's happening.
Yeah. I had an experience years ago I often use when I'm talking about mindfulness with folks, which is years ago, one of my earlier parts of my career, I was running around teaching courses in data communications. And I remember one time many years ago, we were taken, the class that I was teaching, we were taken on a little field trip to an operations center for one of the big, I think it was NYNEX at the time, you know, one of the big telephone networks. And we got to be up in this observation deck and looked down upon all those folks down there who were at their consoles and, you know, in these big maps of where there were issues happening. And, you know, had there been some emergency going on, we would have observed all these people running around seeming very, you know, very upset and very, you know, focused and intense. And we would have been up in this observation just saying, oh, isn't that interesting? Look how intense it is.
Yeah.
And that's often, I often use that as sort of a metaphor for mindfulness, that you can, that part of your brain that can just step to the observation deck and look and say, oh, look at all that stuff going on. Wow, there must be a lot of anxiety down there. You know.
Wow, that's very interesting. So I like that, the observation deck, right? Yeah. When I explain mindfulness, and sometimes I think, I say to people, imagine that you're, and these aren't my metaphors, these are things I've learned, but you're on the top of a mountain and you're watching the clouds going by. Mm-hmm. It's like the mind watching the mind, but I love the idea of the observation deck of the mind.
Yeah. I think that I think it was a Dan Siegel one, actually, as I re- if I'm remembering right. I remember stealing this one for some meditation work that I use with folks about it's like you're at the bottom of an ocean, apparently able to breathe, that's no problem. Yeah. And you're just looking up at the surface, and sometimes the surface is calm and sometimes it's all choppy and sometimes it's just really, you know, in a big storm. But mm-hmm. where you are at the bottom, it's just calm. It's just, there's nothing, yeah. you know, nothing going on. You can just see all the stuff going on up there.
Yes, yes.
Well, yeah. One of the other practices that you had mentioned was the vulnerability cycle. I'm not sure if practice is the right word, but you want to talk a little bit about the vulnerability cycle?
Sure. The vulnerability cycle is a model that was developed by Michelle Shankman and Mona Fishbane. And Michelle is one of the senior faculty from the Ackerman Institute, and Scott lots of papers about the vulnerability cycle and its usefulness. And I am fortunate to be able to be in a consultation group with Michelle that she leads. Mm-hmm. And the vulnerability cycle forms the basis, I would say, of all the couples work that I do. It's a model where you actually understand the interaction between people. So the vulnerabilities are the things that trigger people. Maybe they feel lonely. Maybe they're worried their partner will leave. They feel abandonment. They feel somebody gets loud and they feel anxiety, right? And then when a person gets triggered and feels whatever it is they're feeling, there's a behavior that follows. Maybe they yell and scream. When they yell and scream, their partner feels their own anxiety, their own, I'm not good enough, I've not performed properly, I'm not okay here. And then they do something. Maybe they shut down, right? And then the more the one partner shuts down, the more the second partner feels, oh my God, they're not here for me. The perhaps abandonment issues arise. And so they pursue to have that need met. But the more they pursue, the more the other person feels, I've failed, I'm not good enough, and the more they shut down. And so that is what interactionalizes the organism of the couple. And it's the dance that they do. And when I literally draw it out for couples, and when they see that, you really just like see it on paper. Oh, so this is the self-sustaining pattern that happens. But that's where they can see it. You can and know that they can change that dance. And of course, it ultimately, there's an exploration of families of origin, because most of the time, I won't say all the time, sometimes there's significant adult later life events that can create triggers. But very often, as I'm sure you know, what triggers us is embedded in our childhood, in the families that we grow up in, as well as the survival strategies that we use, the way we cope. And sometimes it makes sense. I always say to people, the things you feel, the things you do make sense. It just may not be useful in your adult relationships. It made sense growing up. All it's right. how you survived in the home that you grew up in. Yeah. And it's not necessarily needed now.
Good way to think about it.
Yeah, that it is one of my favorite themes that I almost always say pretty much in the first session to every couple, is that I point out, you know, now that we're old buddies and I've known you for 10 minutes, I can already tell, well, at least neither of you's nuts, to use a technical term, which is, and sometimes people say, oh, you haven't seen when we get going, you know, but, and I don't mean to be flippant, as I always say to people, I don't mean to be flippant about mental health issues, but rarely am I working with a couple where one or the other is dealing with psychosis. It's usually, which is to say, all of those reactions that you're talking about have a basis. They may not have a, you know, they may not be super functional now, but exactly as you said, they have a basis. You're not crazy. You came, you know, the usual mixture of genetics and experience, you know, we came by the way we are in a valid way. We're all valid to be who we are. And you work with that. And, you know, when I often use the word faith to describe just that sense that says we're valid to be who we are. That's we are valid individuals. And then you work with it. And yeah.
Yeah. I tototally agree. I'd probably use the language more of saying it makes sense. Like, yeah, look at this. Look what it was like for you growing up. You were never heard, so you got louder to be heard. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. That was the only way you could feel that your voice was there.
Yeah.
And so now that's what you're doing, but it doesn't work in this relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not useful.
Yeah.
And it makes sense.
So I think now might be a good time to go to our listener letter. Is that okay?
Oh, of course.
Okay. So this comes from Terry, and she writes, "Dear Bruce and Judy, I'm a 47-year-old woman married to a 53-year-old man I'll call Tom. I'm writing because I've heard the two of you interview some sex therapists on your podcast, and I'm not sure that's what I need or not. We generally get along okay, but our sex life has been getting to be a problem. We used to have sex about once a week. That was fine. No huge fireworks, but I enjoyed it, and I think Tom did too. But a couple of years ago, maybe it had something to do with the pandemic, Tom started having trouble keeping his erection. He talked to his doctor and got Viagra, which seemed to help at first, but it kept happening. His doctor checked him out and didn't find anything medically wrong with him. He's not on any medications, doesn't smoke, and keeps fit. His testosterone level is normal. I'm starting to worry that he doesn't find me attractive anymore. I also try to keep fit, but at 47, I don't look like a supermodel, not that I ever did. I've asked him, and he says he thinks I'm as attractive as ever and that it's not me. But I know he's able to masturbate. He admitted it when I asked him. So I can't figure out why it doesn't work when we're together. Is this something I should talk to a sex therapist about? Or can any couples therapist handle this? Or should I suggest that Tom go to an individual counselor? What do you think I should do?" So Wendy, we turned it over to you.
Wow, that is such a beautiful description. She really didn't leave anything out. She really is very thoughtful about the whole scenario. Mm-hmm. First, I want to say that I don't think I've ever met a woman whose husband has had erectile issues or lack of interest, who hasn't first gone to blame herself.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I noticed that too. I've often commented, I think there's something biological about it. You know, evolutionary terms, it's like you're supposed to blame yourself, even though it isn't true, but you're supposed to blame yourself or something. I don't know. I'm talking to women.
Yeah.
You can tell me what you think.
Women.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, well, the whole societal sexual message is that men are sex monsters and they will want, you know, they'll jump on anything, right? Which, of course, isn't true.
Yeah.
And women, it's like, well, but he doesn't want me anymore. It must be me, right? Oh, he can masturbate. It's interesting that she knows that he can masturbate. That's usually a question that I will ask privately with men. And I will say that men, without fail, always, almost always tell me, no, it's not. It's not my wife.
Yes,
it's not that.
I hear that too. Exactly. Something. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are different ways to approach this. I would encourage them to see someone who is trained in sex therapy. It sounds like the couple's relationship is in a good place overall. A lot of times people come for sexual issues, but the marriage itself has so much going on and conflict and patterns that aren't useful that you have to do kind of some groundwork before you can even get to the sexual issues. Although they're also embedded and throughout and have meaning as well in the other issues. But I would encourage her to see someone who is trained in sexual issues. And, you know, as I was listening to her story and especially the age of her husband, it's good that he absolutely gets checked out medically and makes sure that not only with his system, you know, his urological system, that everything is okay there, but also cardiovascularly, that everything is okay. Because what can happen is if men have, suddenly they have erectile issues and that weren't there before, it could show, because just as the bigger vessels that go to the heart can get blocked, so can the smaller vessels that supply blood to the the penis. So,
and I understand, they'll often show it first, right? That's the thing. The small vessels that supply blood to the penis are apt to, you know, not have enough there as an early sign that maybe you're not getting enough blood altogether because there's some blockage, you know, in some artery somewhere.
Right. Yes. Absolutely. And so that's very important to rule out any medical issues. But it sounds like this is a fit gentleman, and the fact that he can have an erection when he masturbates also speaks to the fact that it's not it's not likely to be something like blocked vessels, because there's no amount of masturbation that will change that, right? Mm-hmm. That's not, the erection is not going to present if that there's a physical barrier to it.
Yeah.
A colleague of mine and another mentor in the field has just written a book. His name is Dr. Dan Water, W-A-T-T-E-R. Mm-hmm. He has written a book called The Existential Life of the Penis. It's a man's guide to sexuality. And he would ask the question. And there's actually a chapter in the book that is The Penis Speaks. And so we have to ask, what is the penis saying?
I'm sorry, here? I'm getting the a visual here.
What is the penis saying? In some way, it is saying, oh my goodness, there is something, all of this unconscious, of course, but a full exploration, family of origin, history. What is this man's penis saying? And also, I know, you know, Dan comes from a very existential view. He had supervised with Victor Yalom, Irvin Yalom.
Yeah,
I'm getting Victor Frankl confused with Yalom way back when, and he has a very existential view, and it's fascinating to hear him talk about these cases. But I think Dan would also be talking about a death anxiety that might be present as men get into certain ages. Mm-hmm. and understanding more, you know, without understanding it, knowing this gentleman's family of origin and his history, I think it would be hard to comment. But what is his penis saying? I'm curious as to why his penis works elsewhere but not here with his wife. He probably is still attracted to, and most 47-year-old women, having probably had a couple of kids, our bodies are not necessarily what they were when we were 27, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's so interesting, you know, all those men who say, it really isn't her. And of course, man myself, and I'm thinking, yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean by that. It isn't her, you know? And I think it's often hard for women to understand that no, it isn't anything personal about her. There may be other things indeed that aren't necessarily medical per se, but there may be other things distracting him. And of course, one of the biggies that I see in this, and I'm curious to see if this fits into your the model of the vulnerability cycle, that just the fact that, as so often, she's starting to worry, oh no, is it me? Do you not find me attractive? And he starts to worry then, oh no, I'm letting her down. I'm giving, you know, I'm making my wife feel bad. My wife, whom I love, I'm making her feel bad. And I don't want to make her feel bad. And so his anxiety goes up, which is the least sexy thing possible. And so no wonder his penis wilts, because he's too busy worrying about, oh no, am I hurting my wife? And, you know, it's a nasty cycle. I don't know, does that sort of fit into the notion of a vulnerability?
Absolutely. Yeah. That interactionalizes what's going on between them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then another thought on this is to help this couple in this couple's age. I mean, look, all those Masters and Johnson studies were done back on 18, 20-year-olds, right? We are not 18, 20 our whole lives. And so sometimes it requires, and this is, you know, again, I go back to Suzanne Iacenza, expanding the sexual menu. And, you know, there are so many other things that couples can do to be close, to be connected, to be sexual with each other. And sex, the definition of sex expands. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to mean penetration. It doesn't even have to mean orgasm. Mm-hmm. To create a soft penis menu, sexual menu, where, mm-hmm. where a hard penis is not even required for that.
It's interesting. So, there's a hint in the letter, I think. I'm looking at a copy of it here. There's a hint in the letter that, you know, we used to have sex about once a week. That was fine. No huge fireworks, but I enjoyed it. And I think Tom did too. There's an implication there. It's not like everybody mm-hmm. has to have fireworks all the time, but there's an implication there that it was perhaps getting kind of routine and they weren't really exploring mm-hmm. other, you know, expanding their repertoire at all.
And another thing that she also mentioned, she didn't know if it had something to do with the pandemic, that, you know, we don't know how that affected his mental well-being either. If there was a change in job, a change in job status, a change in responsibility, and how that's affecting, you know, that put a lot of stress on people in so many ways, that could also be playing into it.
Yes, I agree. And also the fact that a lot of people ended up working from home, so they don't have, all those usual extra social engagements that we had in our lives, we didn't have. Right. Even just being at work and perhaps that made this gentleman feel more vital and interacting with people versus, you know, sitting in a home office or a makeshift office in an extra bedroom or something, right. and doing their work that way. So yes,
we're smiling because
we're sitting in a home office
in an extra bedroom. Although we happen to be away. We live in Vermont. We happen to be in Florida at the moment when we're recording this, but we're in a rental place here. But yeah, we have an extra bedroom because I work by telehealth. And so here we are in our home office in our extra bedroom, so I can relate. And because of the pandemic, as a matter of fact, that's when I started. Wow. That's when I shut down my personal office space.
Mm. Yeah. Yes, I still have my office space, but I don't use it nearly as much.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah.
There's been changes for everybody. Yes, I agree. The layer of the pandemic is a whole other area of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
most definitely.
Well, I hope, Terry, that that helps you. And I mean, we change names of folks, so but in any case, we actually don't know this person beyond having got a letter from her. Mm-hmm. But I hope that is helpful for her. Where should we send people if they want to learn more about you or your work or get in touch with you, or what should we do?
Oh, I have a website. It's wendydumbrofftherapy.com. It's Wendy with an I at the end. Most people spell it with a Y, so that makes a difference. But all my information is on there, wendydumbrofftherapy.com.
And are there any other topics that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched on?
You know, I have one last thought for Terry. The reason that I say someone who's trained in sex therapy is not all couples therapists are even comfortable talking about sex, but many are. So I think the reason that I guide her more to somebody who is trained in sex therapy, or really any couples therapist that has comfort in that area.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little anecdote. I think I've mentioned this before on our podcast. Mm-hmm. I was at a training within the past year, a few months ago, it's a continuing education training, as we all need. And this was for specifically about couples therapy. So it was on Zoom. There were like 100 therapists there, the vast majority of which I'm pretty sure I did practice couples therapy. And the trainer asked people, did a little poll, you know, on Zoom and said, okay, mm-hmm. how many of you ask couples, if they haven't mentioned it already, how many of you ask couples about their sex life in the first or second session? And I'm sitting there thinking, well, we all do that, don't we? And then the poll came back and it was about 30%. I think it was about 30, 40, below 50%. Like, And I was flabbergasted, frankly, because like, holy cow, all these therapists. And then some people would describe this. I don't know. I wait for them to bring it up as if it's like it's this sort of, you know, forbidden topic, or you have to handle it really carefully. And of course, you convey that to your clients and then they're afraid to bring it up, too.
Wow.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's crazy.
Sex and money, right? Sex and money, the two biggest taboo subjects.
Yeah, well, and religion, actually, spirituality.
Religion and
politics, yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah, all of the above. I asked about all of them.
Yeah, yes. Wow.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's been a pleasure to speak with both of you.
Great. It's been very enlightening. I always learn so much from our guests. That's why I like doing this podcast, I think, more than anything else.
Absolutely. Me too. Yes. I learned a tremendous amount. Well, thank you, Wendy.
I always learn when I do them as well. So I thank you as well.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Wendy Dumbroff. As I said to Wendy, I'm always learning a lot from our guests, and she certainly had a lot of good things to say.
She did indeed, and as I mentioned, just very knowledgeable and a lot of the names of the folks that she mentioned that she studies with or is mentored by, those are well-known folks and very respected folks in the field. So she is keyed into that, and I learned a lot from her as well.
Yeah.
So we would like to invite you to rate us and subscribe to us and do all those sorts of things that let other people know about this podcast. Mm-hmm. You can do that right from, you can subscribe using whatever platform you get this on. And also, if you can share and like and follow our social media posts, we're basically on Facebook, that's
right,
where we
pretty
are.
Pretty much, that's it.
At Couples Therapy in 7 Words, you'll right. find it there. You can also go to @DrBruceChalmer and you'll see some stuff there, and we often cross post between those two.
Right. And if you go to our website, ctn7.com, you can see a place where if you, like Terry, have a question you'd like us to put on the air, write to us. And there's a spot there where you can write to us. There's also a place where you can suggest guests. And if you would like to be a guest on our program, you can put yourself down as a guest.
And you can even sign up for a time. I've got a, what is it called, Calendly link?
Yeah.
Calendly, however they pronounce that.
Yeah.
Folks, the mavens out there who do scheduling will know what I'm talking about. It's basically a link to our calendar that lets you sign up for a time. You'll see what's available.
Yep.
We usually record on Fridays. Mm-hmm. We can sometimes accommodate other times too. So if you drop us a line. And just drop us a line and give us some feedback. What do you think about this?
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. We love hearing from our listeners.
We do indeed. And let's put in another word for the books I've written. We didn't mention the book I wrote a couple years ago, which
That's
is...
That's right, in the intro we
in
did
the
not.
Intro.
So we will say that in the outro. Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back.
And that's been out for coming up on 3 years, amazingly. Yeah, three years.
Yeah, it started, it was released right at the,
it was released
the pandemic.
Right at the pandemic. And in fact, it was, I think it was like February 29th of 2020. It was on Leap Day.
I think it was. Yeah. And that's how we ended up doing the podcast, because we couldn't make any public appearances.
That's right. And so here we are. The rest is history.
Here
we're still doing
it.
This is episode, I think it's what, 103 or 104?
It's over
100, yeah. And so you can get that book. And then my much more recent book, which just came out a few weeks ago.
Right. It's Not About Communication: Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
And if you find that a provocative title, and if you think, well, that's ridiculous or that's arrogant or whatever, I urge you, read the book. And you may still think that after you've read the book, in which case, write me a letter and tell me that. And you know what? If you write me an articulate enough letter complaining about my book, I will be inclined to invite you on the podcast, because I love that.
I don't know. Maybe you shouldn't say that. Maybe you'll scare them away.
No, not at all. Well, you don't have to accept, folks. Just because I invite you doesn't mean you have to come on.
That's
no,
true.
I'm really trying to engage folks by having a title that is as frankly silly as that. Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong is rather overstated, shall we say. But the book does bust some myths.
Yes, it does.
That's what it's about. And you may disagree with me, and I want to hear that. And look, I always like to throw in, spoiler alert, folks, in the last chapter of my book, I do point out, it's not just you. Everything I know about couples therapy is wrong too. And, you know, what do I mean by that? I don't literally mean everything I'm saying is nonsense.
Don't give away the book.
I don't want to give away the book. But I can say what I mean by that, which is simply that the book has a couple of chapters on this.
Yes.
It's the knowing part. It's the think you know too much part. Mm-hmm. That's the part that's dangerous. It's when ideas, which, you know, ideas are open you up and expose you to things you hadn't thought of, when they turn into ideologies, that's what does damage. And that's true in the therapy world, and it's true in relationships, and that's what I write about in the book. So I hope you'll read that. And of course, we want to hear from you about the book as well. Really looking for folks to do, you hear me hesitating before I say Amazon, the A word, you know, but that's how people find out about books these days.
That's where most people are.
Do an Amazon review, you know. Of course, we'd like it to be a 5-star review, but do an Amazon review, you know, rate it and review it. That, of course, helps let people know about it. It helps Amazon's algorithms tell other folks about it.
Definitely.
I think we've covered what we need to cover.
I think we have.
Well, good. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.